Good. I suggest we now make a start. And I hope you can hear me, first of all. The microphone is working? Okay, good. So welcome to this, the sixth annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory here at the school. As some of you are well aware, but perhaps not all of you, the Hellenic Observatory is part of the European Institute at the school, and it exists to promote the teaching and research on contemporary Greece and Cyprus. Our annual lecture is the most prestigious public platform we have, and the annual lecture has established itself as, I think, a prominent part in our activity. Previous speakers in this series have included, for example, Professor Lukas Papadimos, now Vice President of the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, Dr. George Alagoskoufis, now Minister of National Economy in Athens, Dr. Yanis Papandreou, most recently Minister of Defense. In other words, the lecture is an opportunity for a major figure to connect with the study of Greece in a wider international agenda. And tonight's topic is a case in point. Our title, European Integration, What is at Stake Now for the British, for the Greeks, and for others, is indicative of connecting the study of Greece with a wider European agenda. And it's a special privilege for me to introduce our speaker, Lukas Zoukalis. Lukas was the first holder of the chair on contemporary Greek studies here at the school, I think from 1998 to 2001. And therefore, he was my own immediate predecessor. As such, Lukas established the profile of the Hellenic Observatory, its program, its international links, and established a sound basis for others to follow. Lukas's profile, when he came to the school in 1998, neatly matched that of the European Institute and of the chair, with his combination of interests in European political economy and his knowledge of Greece. And of course, as many of you are well aware, Lukas has had an outstanding career. He was educated at Oxford, and he subsequently taught there. He's also taught at the College of Europe in Bruges, and he currently holds a visiting appointment at the European University Institute in Florence. Previously, he was editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. Currently, he's president of ELIOMEP, the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy in Athens. Currently, he's also Jean Monnet Professor of European Integration at the University of Athens. Lukas is one of those rare figures who's managed to combine a number of different career interests. He's made a success of wearing different hats at the same time. He has his own consultancy organization in Athens. He's a major player in a family business. He's a regular contributor to public debate in Greece. And amongst all of those things, he finds time to teach and to research and to write. About a year ago, Lukas wrote a book for Oxford University Press entitled What Kind of Europe? His aim was to pinpoint the issues, political, economic, security, regional, global, the issues that will shape the future of the European Union. And the book has been very well received. It has had enthusiastic reviews in both the press and academic journals. Stanley Hoffman, for example, from Harvard, wrote in Foreign Affairs that it was a most extraordinary piece of work. What kind of Europe? That question forms the academic backdrop to tonight's lecture. And I'm sure Lukas will stimulate our thoughts on a range of pertinent issues. Now, Lukas, I think, will speak for about 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes, and then he'll take questions from the audience. After we finish, there is a reception here in this building to which you are all entitled, all invited, entitled to come. You can see that I'm very conscious about budgets and resources these days. So, yes, you are all entitled to come to the reception. The reception is going to be held in the staff common room, which is on the fifth floor of this building, and that will be immediately after the lecture. So you're welcome to attend that reception. But on a personal basis, let me say to Lucas that it's a privilege to welcome him back here to the Hernecker Observatory and to the school. It has indeed been a privilege to follow in your footsteps here with the observatory, and we're delighted to have this opportunity of catching up with your current interests and your work. So please, ladies and gentlemen, please give a very warm LSE welcome to our speaker this evening, Lucas Sicali.
Thank you, Kevin, for your very kind words. Thank you for inviting me to give this sixth annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory. It's a great pleasure to be back. It's a greater pleasure to discover that the Hellenic Observatory is thriving, and so is indeed the European Institute. And it is certainly both a pleasure and a privilege to be invited to address you tonight and deliver this annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory. The title of my lecture is European Integration, What is at Stake Now for British, Greeks and Others? And this is a very broad theme. It would be difficult to be broader than that. And that perhaps deserves an explanation before I get on with the subject. I believe that the European Union has now reached a very difficult and critical turning point. Decisions that will be taken in the next months, if not in the next year or so, will shape the European construction for years to come. And there is much at stake. And that, I think, explains why sometimes we need to try at least a look at the broad picture instead of concentrating on micro manifestations of European integration. And this is also hopefully an explanation why the political animal sometimes parts company from the ivory tower academic. So this is going to be a lecture with a political argument. So let me start by saying a few words about what European integration has achieved until now. It may sound commonplace to some of you, but I think it is important and essential before we go on to discuss current issues and what is to be done. Now, we have more than 50 years of history behind us, and in the process we have all collectively produced a regional system which has no precedent in history and no rival in any other part of the world. I believe it is a regional system for which Europeans, or at least most Europeans, have every reason to be proud of. And it has been some kind of a peaceful revolution which has transformed or has contributed to transforming political and economic order in Europe. What is European integration all about? It seems to me that, first of all, European integration is about the joint management of interdependence. And there is interdependence which started from trade in goods and moved all the way to cover all kinds of economic transactions and now also political interdependence. But unlike the famous or notorious process of globalization, interdependence in Europe is managed. There is governance in Europe. Government is not a dirty word in Europe, unlike other parts of the world. And it is not a dirty word in Europe, I think, for a number of reasons. It may have something to do with the fact that the European continent is crowded, it has a long and troubled history, and it has to produce rules that govern the interaction of different cultures, different political systems, and different economic systems. So we need governance. And that is an important qualifying aspect of European integration. At the same time, the everyday life of citizens of the UK, Greece, and all other countries in Europe is very much influenced by decisions and legislation emanating from European institutions, albeit with the participation of national representatives. So much of our prosperity depends essentially on the management of this economic interdependence. So that's one aspect of European integration. The other aspect, something which most people would not have expected to materialize, is that European integration until now has contributed in a very significant way in stabilizing, democratizing, and modernizing large parts of the European periphery. And in so doing, it has helped to reduce the distance, political, economic, and also cultural, between the center and the periphery in Europe. example is that Greece is a very different country from what it used to be 20 years ago. And much of that difference is owed to its participation in the European Union. And this perhaps also explains why the European Union in general tends to be more popular in Greece than in this country. So the European integration has served as some kind of a convergence machine for many of the European countries. It also started as an instrument of reconciliation between France and Germany. And in the process, this was extended to other parts of the European continent. Yet, the main instruments of war are still at the hands of national governments. And to the extent that European national governments decide to collaborate with others, they prefer to collaborate in the context of NATO rather than the European Union, and they prefer to do that with the United States rather than with other European allies. That applies to the majority of European countries. So the European Union and European integration is not yet a vehicle for peace, collaboration in the area of defense. It's only the beginning. Furthermore, European integration has served as a vehicle for projecting collective power abroad. This has worked very well in the case of trade. It has worked less well in other manifestations of economic life, and even less well in what international relations people refer to with awe as high politics. The European Union is a political system, I believe. It is a political system which is highly decentralized, and it has a number of very important characteristics. First of all, it is a political system where all countries are equal, but of course some countries are more equal than others. And this is not surprising. It would be surprising if Luxembourg and Germany carried the same weight in the European Union. Yet, it is a system that has had no hegemonic power until now, unlike empires in the past. It is not a traditional concept of power. And it is a system in which small and medium-sized countries carry much more weight than they would have ever imagined in an intergovernmental context. This again explains why Greece is more keen on the European Union than perhaps the UK. But it is also a political system which relies highly decentralized. The nation states still remain the main constituent parts of the system. It is a system that relies on big majorities and on consensus. And therefore, it is a political system that is slow, conservative, increasingly bureaucratic. It sometimes smacks of privilege, and it suffers from a big democratic deficit in the sense that there's a big gap between policies produced at the level of the European Union and politics at the level of the European Union. Or to put it differently, there's a huge gap between the importance of issues that are discussed and decided at the European level and the knowledge and understanding that European citizens have of that process. This is a dangerous gap. So this is a very quick summary in 10 minutes of what I think European integration has been all about until now. The European system has generally been accused of being slow, unable to deliver the goods. Yet if you think about it, think as what has happened in the last 4 years, since the beginning of this century. The EU has delivered a single currency for at least 12 members of the European Union, which is clearly the most important thing that has happened in European integration since the very beginning. It has admitted 10 countries join, and it has also produced a constitution, although a constitution which looks more like a treaty than a constitution. This is not bad. It's not a bad record by any standards, especially for a system that is supposed to be slow and unable to deliver goods. Yet, I think that we are going through a very difficult phase. There is growing self-doubt and pessimism in Europe. There is an increasing number of people who talk about the European project having reached its limits. And some people, in fact, argue that we are already on reverse gear. So what I will try to do from now on is offer some possible explanations about the self-doubt and the pessimism, and add a few things about what can or should be done, with which I'm sure not all of you will agree. Now let's go back to the fundamentals and see what are the fundamentals and what has changed in recent years. First of all, we have to remember that European integration started essentially as an economic affair. And economics remains the backbone of European integration. We also have to remember that for decades, European integration was perceived as delivering the goods. European integration went hand in hand with high rates of economic growth and with very low levels of unemployment. And this was a result of what some people like me argue this was a result of virtuous circles. Now, as we all know, the economic performance of the majority of European countries has not been good, and it has been deteriorating steadily in the last 20 years. Unfavorable comparisons between the United States and the European Union have become standard fare. And although those unfavorable comparisons are in fact, or should be in fact, less unfavorable, if you look more closely at figures, let me explain what I mean by that. Everybody points to the difference in terms of growth rates between the United States and the European Union. Now, looking more closely at the figures, you will discover, first of all, that if you make allowance for different birth rates, the differences in growth rates become much smaller. Second, if you make allowance for the special problem of the German economy, after unification, the problem virtually disappears. Third, if you make allowance for the fact that the trade-off between work and leisure in Europe seems to be quite different from the trade-off in the United States, and there can be legitimate differences about trade-offs, that again explains partly different economic performances. And last but not least, the dynamism of the U.S. economy has been based, at least partly, on the twin unsustainable deficits of the U.S. economy. So this is something we do not have in Europe. But having said all that, there is a problem. There's an economic problem in Europe. And I believe that a stagnating economy with few jobs and an aging population is going to be a recipe for disaster, not only for the generous welfare states of Europe, at least for most of our countries, but also for European integration in general. So something needs to be done. And something needs to be done both on the macroeconomic front as well as in terms of internal structural reforms. I believe that, first of all, monetary union requires more active management in terms of macroeconomic policy. We could have done in recent years with a more lax monetary policy, so perhaps we could have learned something from what has happened on the other side of the Atlantic. And I believe that a more favorable macroeconomic environment helps with the introduction of unpopular internal structural reforms, which are badly needed. And they are badly needed, especially in countries like Germany and France, and much less in the UK. Now, we therefore need to recreate conditions for a different kind or a new kind of virtuous circle in Europe. And that will have to combine a more favorable macroeconomic environment with internal structural reforms. Now, there's a difference between the two, because macroeconomics is largely in the hands of European institutions, at least for the countries of the Eurozone, while internal structural reform is in the hands of national governments. The only thing I'm arguing is that a more favorable macroeconomic environment will facilitate structural reforms at the national level. But there is no guarantee that those things will happen, and there is certainly no guarantee that it will happen at the same pace in different European countries. There is both competition and solidarity in the European system. Some are bound to be more successful than others. In that respect, the British are doing much better than the average European country, and certainly much better than the Greeks. Now, Having said that, I should add that it is not just a question of imitating the American model. I don't think there is a majority in the European Union for imitating the Americans. There are lessons to be learned from the American model, but there's certainly no way of imitating. And as far as Europe is concerned, apart from structural reforms, the key problem for European governments in the next few years is how they're going to deal with losers. Losers arising from the rapid pace of adjustment both inside Europe and internationally. This is going to be a major issue because this is going to be an issue that will determine the political and social feasibility of those reforms. Now, that's so much about the economy. The second issue is enlargement. In the past, the European Union has tried to combine widening with deepening. And as we all know, a few months ago, the European Union admitted 10 new countries. It is obviously the biggest ever enlargement, and it will certainly be the most difficult enlargement that we've ever had. And it's going to be very difficult, not only because these are countries with relatively weak economies, but these are also countries that come with deep scars from a long period of totalitarian rule, with little confidence of their citizens in the domestic political systems, little confidence and trust in political institutions. It is going to be difficult to digest and Europeanize those 10 new members. And this enlargement is not going to be cheap either. Now, having said all that, we then have to add that there are many more countries waiting in the queue. There are the other Balkan countries, there's of course Turkey, and who knows, we may then have to deal with the Ukraine, with Georgia, and I don't know where the border lies. Now, some people argue that modernization and stabilization of the periphery is the new most important mission of the European Union. And I have nothing against it on one condition. And this is that there is a functioning center still that helps to modernize the periphery. Because if successive enlargements act as a boomerang against the European Union, and the European Union becomes diluted and ends up with very weak political institutions, there will be no stabilization and no modernization. And I think there's also a fundamental, simple question that needs to be asked. And this is, how much diversity can any political system, not to mention the European political system, take before it implodes? So this is a legitimate question that Europeans have to ask and provide answers. The third issue relates to foreign policy. We all know that the European Union has developed its capacity as essentially a soft power. A soft power that relies mostly on aid, on nation and state building as a way of stabilizing other parts of the world. It does not rely on weapons. Now, this is all sounds good, but we know also that the European Union, in many respects, has been an extremely frustrated power. The Europeans, admittedly, or most Europeans, show very little taste for playing the role of the world's policeman. But having said that, this does not solve or does not spare Europe of very awkward choices and dilemmas. For example, what do you do if, rightly or wrongly, you perceive that the only remaining superpower adds to the instability of world order through its actions? And suppose you believe that to be true, what do you do? Now, I think that in the next few years, the Europeans will have not only to work harder in terms of a common foreign policy, but ideally add some muscle to the soft power that they have developed all these years. Now, in strengthening European unity, they may discover that this carries with it some anti-American element, because a stronger Europe is bound to be not only a counterpart, but also sometimes a counterweight to the United States when Europeans disagree with the Americans. And this is fair enough, as long as you do not think that unipolarity is so much better to any kind of multipolarity in the world system. But the future of European integration, and certainly the future of a common European foreign policy, depends largely on the ability of Europeans to define a policy vis-à-vis, not against, the United States. And in that respect, they have usually failed to deliver. Now, my fourth factor or fourth fundamental relates to the role of citizens. As we all know, European integration started essentially as an elitist construction, and it has remained all along an elitist construction. The gap between policy and politics, as I mentioned before, has become wider, ever wider. The gap between economics and politics, the gap between perception and reality has grown. So while there has been a transfer of powers, and a steady transfer of powers, from the national to the European level, European citizens have not been able to play an active role in this European political system. And they do not even perceive that as important. National political classes have failed to deliver a European message. They have failed to present to European citizens the kind of democratic choices that are involved behind the policies that are pursued and decided at the European level. And this has led to growing alienation and disappointment. Popular support for European integration has been declining steadily for more than 10 years. I think that it is absolutely crucial that the European project becomes more politicized in the years to come. And in the increasing politicization of the European project, which puts the emphasis on democratic choices to be made, we will discover increasingly that what counts is not necessarily whether you're British or Greek, German, Finnish, or Portuguese. But with the growing politicization of European integration, we may discover that what counts more is whether you belong to the left or the right, the left of center or the right of center. Because with the deepening of European integration, the intra-country effects, distributive effects, are becoming much more important than the inter-country effects. And this has not been perceived as yet by the large majority of European citizens. Now, my main point is that the old European project is still valid. It is about peace, security, democracy, and prosperity through open borders and shared sovereignty. It is also about the defense of basic common values in a world where Europe no longer occupies a seat at the center. Weak European institutions can just about manage a loose association of states and a free trade area. Weak European institutions cannot manage a monetary union. They cannot play an active role in stabilizing the periphery or other parts of the world. And this is really the bottom line. This is what we have to decide on in the next few months and years. Whether we want a European political system that delivers that kind of goods or not. And I personally think that we need, if the European project is still valid, we need strong and effective institutions. And we need also a functioning democratic system at the European level for the things that we decide to do together. And it is not necessary that we have to do too many things together. But those that we do together, we have to do it efficiently, and we have to back them up with a proper European public debate and with well-functioning democratic systems. Of course, there are people who do not like the idea of sharing, who may prefer different partners, or who may think of the European Union as a superstate largely because they have or they support different versions of market fundamentalism. They do not like governance. And that brings me to a few quick comments on the Constitution. A Constitution which, of course, is more like a treaty. The treaty, the Constitution signed in October this year in Rome, does not bring about radical change. It is certainly more important than Amsterdam and Nice, and it is certainly less important than Maastricht. After all, nothing compares with the political and economic consequences of a monetary union. So the Constitution is the product of compromise. Some people who argue, for example, that it is not the kind of short, neat text that we want, and we can call it a proper constitution, forget that the main reason we have long articles and complicated articles about different things is precisely because we do not have a superstate in Europe, and because national governments insist on detailed provisions in order to protect themselves from trespassing from European institutions. If we had a European superstate, the Constitution would have been much simpler and neater, but it isn't. So the Constitution is in the long tradition of incremental steps. It brings changes mainly in terms of institutions and hardly any changes in terms of policies. It is not perfect. And in fact, it's going to be a difficult thing to sell to voters. I mean, imagine for those countries, including this one, the UK, where there will be popular referenda. Now, if a politician goes to an audience and starts talking about double majority, about the president of the European Council, and about enhanced cooperation, he or she will have lost the audience from the first 5 minutes. So the Constitution itself is not an easy text to sell to citizens. There is a risk, and there's always a risk with referenda, that first of all, the referendum can be hijacked by demagogues. It can be hijacked by issues that are totally irrelevant to what is actually being decided. People may vote for or against governments in power, or people may simply not bother to vote. The only way, I believe, to convince people to vote is to go to the bottom line. The question about the European Constitution or the Constitutional Treaty is not about different kinds of policies, about whether we want a more social Europe or a less social Europe, because this is not decided by the European Constitution. The European Constitution is a step towards a stronger, more efficient Europe and a more democratic Europe. That's all. But the crucial question is whether we believe or we want to support a European project that puts the emphasis on open borders, shared sovereignty, and defense of basic common values, or not. If we do not like the idea of sharing, or if we prefer different partners, then we vote against the Constitution. And that, I believe, should be the bottom line for those who sell, or, if I may use the expression, sell the Constitution to voters. Unfortunately, we have not been able to convince our government back home in Athens to have a referendum on the Constitution in Greece, so there's going to be a simple ratification by the National Parliament. And my only hope is that once the Constitution is ratified, if it isn't ratified, you have to remember that people have invested, all Europeans have invested a huge amount of political capital in it. If it fails, there's going to be, I think, a political crisis in Europe, And this is going to be a major setback for further enlargement. So this is also something to bear in mind. And assuming that the Constitution is ratified, then I hope that this acts as a catalyst for a much wider public debate on the key democratic issues about the European project. Thank you very much. Shall I?
Good. We have. Thank you, Luca, for that presentation and for your breadth of coverage. We have a number of things to pursue, and so I'll throw the opportunity open to you to raise questions on the basis of the lecture that Lucas has just given. Please, over here. Could you identify yourself and focus on the question?
Yes. Hello. My name's Adrian Basiri. I'm a first-year student of geography with economics. You talked about the dilution of culture and whether this, if diluted enough, may pose some detrimental questions towards the European Union as a political function. Do you believe that perhaps Turkey or Albania, when entering the EU, will provide such cultural dilution, which will prove to be politically unviable within the European Union?
I don't think I use the word dilution. I talked about diversity, and I said that there is so much diversity that any political system can take. So obviously the accession of Turkey presents a problem. Why does it present a problem? Because Turkey is too big, too poor, and too different. Right? It's a combination of the three. Now, I have been for long a supporter of Turkey's rapprochement with the European Union. And I'm still a supporter of an eventual accession of Turkey to the European Union, but on the condition that the European Union is strong enough to absorb Turkey and that it does not destroy itself in the process. I, for one, for example, if the constitutional treaty fails, I would be against any further enlargements. So this has to be set on the table, that those people who want further enlargements, they have to support strong European institutions. If they simply want to dilute the European Union, then those of us who still believe in a European political project will be against.
Thank you. Gentleman down here. Is there a microphone? No, the gentleman to your left.
I'm a consultant. I'm working as a consultant for the European Union. My question is special. What do you mean by integration? Because in reality, there is no integration. It's just putting things together. For me, integration is, let's say, a really integration is, it means working together and trying to develop a strategy for the euro. Second question, we are talking about, let's say, institution. You don't mention the question of private sector working together with institutions, and so the partnership where this is will lead to a more strong Europe and more vision, more integration. Thank you.
What I mean by integration is the creation of a framework in which there is growing interaction in economic, political terms. I do not want, personally, a unified Europe following in the steps of a European nation state. I think that diversity in Europe is one of the great advantages that we have, and we should preserve it as much as possible. So we have created the conditions for the sharing of sovereignty, which has absolutely no precedent in world history. I mean, no other sovereign states have gone that far in sharing many of the attributes of their sovereignty. But I certainly do not want centralization of power. And I also am not sure that the ever extension of powers of European institutions is necessarily a good thing. It would be much better to do fewer things and do them better instead of trying to do everything.
So, you know, I'm a federalist, if I may use that word in England. I'm a federalist who understands that federalism goes together with subsidiarity, which is a popular term in Britain.
Thank you. Yes, please, here.
My name is George Alimonos. I'm a research student and a journalist. And I was wondering, if you were in an auditorium like you are now, and you were trying to sell European Union after the integration into students or young voters from across the European Union states, what would you sell them and vote for the Constitution? Thank you.
You have a point, because in many ways the European project looks old and tired. And it is the kind of project and the kind of language it uses which is addressing itself more to older generations, people who still remember or at least have some kind of distant memory of the Second World War. This is ancient history to the young generation. I mean, talking to them about the reconciliation between France and Germany, it doesn't make much sense because they take it for granted. So one has to adapt the language. But I think the argument about open borders and the sharing of some things that we can do more efficiently at the European level can make sense as long as you can give concrete examples. The problem with the European project is, I talked about it being old and tired, it is increasingly bureaucratic and it smacks of privilege. And that is very important.
Other questions? Gentleman here in blue.
David Buchan, Financial Times. Lucas, in your splendid talk early on, you were talking about the need to have a higher growth rate and also the need or the question of how to help losers. And excuse me, I wondered whether losers can be individuals, companies, but also regions and countries. Mm-hmm. And there was a rather good report, the Sapir report last year, which identified a kind of trade-off between a higher growth rate and the way in which the EU had traditionally helped losing regions and countries with the regional fund and the structural fund. And it suggested that that money might be better spent towards maximizing the European growth rate. So I wonder do you agree with that there is such a trade-off, and how would you be willing as a Greek to see a radical reduction in this redistribution through the structural and regional funds if it promoted a higher general growth rate? Thank you.
There is obviously a redistribution between countries, between regions, and between different income groups. The biggest part of redistribution will still lie in the hands of national governments, because that is part of the welfare state. And that is in many ways what distinguishes Europe from other parts of the world, the emphasis on equality and solidarity, which I hope remains. Now, having said that, I think also the important achievement of integration until now has been that it has not relied only on liberalization, but it has also accepted a small, but symbolically and politically important, element of redistribution among countries. I hope that remains, because market integration is one thing, and creating the conditions for higher growth is very important, and I think we should do more about it. But still, I think it is crucial that the European Union preserves an element of redistribution helping less developed regions. And this is important, especially because of the latest enlargement. I mean, I do hope, honestly, that the Latvians, the Slovaks, and the Poles will be able to benefit from the help from structural funds, more efficiently managed, hopefully, in the next few years, as the Greeks, the Portuguese, and the Irish have benefited until now. So, yes, I'm with you. that, and with the Sapir report, that more emphasis should be placed on growth-oriented policies. We need more growth. But that does not mean that we should completely abandon structural funds.
Thank you. Here, please.
This is Ozan Sakar, doing philosophy and economics. Well, you have said that you are a federalist, and you're also in favor of decentralization. And as far as I understand, you also say that you need a very strongly functioning governance to make sure that integration process works. But what I don't understand is that you have also said that, for example, to stabilize or modernize the periphery countries, and for the European Union itself to work, you need those functioning governance, basically. Don't want to repeat myself again. What would you change to strengthen this function then? I mean, how would you make sure that there is very strong governance? Because you have said that decentralization should be there. I mean, doesn't it matter that you do need some centralization if you want a very powerful or a strong governance there? I mean, how would you also legitimize the use of this strength as well? You have also said that people are ignorant or they're not very well educated about the European Union and its workings. I mean, how would you make sure that the people go there and vote for it and basically legitimize this function, the strength of the Union?
Well, first of all, what I mean is that I want to have a more effective commission, council, and parliament that can actually decide. In that respect, some of the changes introduced by the new constitution, constitutional treaty, whatever you like to call it, go in the right direction. The double majority vote, for example, is much better than the monstrosity produced by Nice. The existence of a more permanent president of the council for 2.5 years will hopefully make the council a more efficient institution than it has been until now. More powers to the European Parliament is a good thing because eventually this may help to generate the kind of European public debate about Europe-wide issues that we haven't had until now. So that's what I mean by more efficient institutions that can actually deliver decisions and policies. There is nothing wrong. I mean, I don't see that as being incompatible with a system where many of the other decisions and powers lie in the hands of national governments. As long as, for example, the welfare system, social policies, and so on, remain more or less a national monopoly, nation states are not in danger of extinguishing themselves, of being extinguished. And I do not see very much happening in terms of social policies and welfare policies in the next few years. And I would add that I'm not even very much in favor of it because of the wide diversity that exists between national systems.
Thanks. Here, please, in the center. There's a microphone coming.
Thank you. Alex Pearson, IISS. Could you give us your view on the idea of a European Defense Force and also the role of the 10 new states and possible other states that could, who have much larger armed forces, what role they would play in such a possible force?
Well, as I'm sure you know better than I do, the European Union has decided to concentrate almost entirely on peacekeeping missions. The European Union does not pretend or have the ambition of turning into a big new entity in terms of defense. Okay? And there is nothing wrong with that. There is a problem, however, if you think about it. The Europeans have relied almost exclusively on soft power, and increasingly they try to make virtue out of necessity because they could not deliver anything else. The Europeans, according to Mr. Cooper, who is now at the Council, have created some kind of a postmodern world in which sovereignty is shared. And they use postmodern instruments. But the trouble is that much of the world around them is in a pre-modern age. Mm-hmm. So you cannot deal with failed states regional conflicts and the threat of international terrorism by relying simply on soft power is not good enough. So this is why I think increasingly we have accepted that we also need some more muscle to be added to the soft power that we have developed. And the history, I think, of European common foreign policy suggests, among other things, that the crucial factor is the ability to define a policy vis-à-vis the superpower. Are the Europeans willing and able to define a common policy vis-à-vis the United States? And I repeat, vis-à-vis, not against. The Americans remain and should remain a very important ally for Europe. But I think it was Winston Churchill who said that allies are good, but the trouble is that with time they tend to develop opinions of their own. And this is the problem in relations between the United States and Europe. Are we allowed sometimes to have different opinions? And if we do, what do we do about it?
Thank you. Here.
Well, I wish to come back. Rafael Papadopoulos, I'm a retired professor of thermodynamics. I wish to come back to that comparison which is made on economic growth between the European Union and the United States. And I wonder how much this measure is relevant to the growth in the welfare of the community at large. I feel one has to put it this way. Secondly, sometimes I wonder whether the people who make this comparison are willing to accept also that if you are going to have American style of economic growth in Europe, you must prepare to accept also, to a certain extent at least, the American type of society. That is the inequality, the friction, the overflowing prisons, the stress, and the rest of it. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think nobody would ever accuse me of being a great admirer of the American, or unqualified admirer of the American model. I always tend to put the emphasis on equality, solidarity, or many of the traditional social democratic values of Europe. So in that respect, but there are lessons to be learned from America as well. The European model was going fine as long as it could deliver growth and jobs. Now, the European model for more than 15 years fails to deliver for most of our countries. The UK is certainly doing much better than the average. The European model is largely failing to deliver growth and jobs. And there is a problem. And there is a problem that we have to address. So we need, I believe, to adjust and reform some of our policies and some of our welfare systems in order to preserve some of the essentials, instead of pretending that everything is going well and we can go on with 11% rates of unemployment in many European countries and with an aging population which is going to lead to the explosion of our social security system in the next few years. And also I can give you another example. I certainly do not want to see the kind of inequalities and social friction that I have in the United States. But I also observe that thousands of European postdoctoral students emigrate to the United States every year, and most of them do not come back. There is a problem with our universities and with our research centers, LSE excluded, I'm sure. Now, something needs to be done there. I mean, the brain drain costs a lot to Europe. So there are things to learn from the United States.
Thanks. Another question. Yoga, here in the center. There's a microphone coming. In fact, perhaps we could group several questions and
whatever you like.
Take it from there. Thank Can we perhaps group a few questions here as well at the front? I'm sorry, we're moving around the room. We'll come here as well. Here at the front, please.
Ray Jackson, ex-student. Over the years, a body of law, European law, has grown up, which in many cases supersedes national law. And this is administered managed by a group of judges, many of whom are administrators, I believe. How effective is this body? And can you give any examples of any penalties they have imposed on defaulting states?
Okay. Can we go in the center here, please?
Maria Toporidis from the European University Institute. I was wondering how, if you could give some comments on how to address the democratic deficit beyond actually strengthening the European Parliament, given that many citizens feel that the Parliament is rather remote as well. So who should we look to take the initiative in that field?
Okay, can we pass you those three okay. Nice, easy questions?
The democratic deficit, well, the most recent European elections were a depressing sight, because not only because of the low turnout, actually I do not blame people for not turning up to vote. To vote for what? Most of our political leaders in most European countries failed abysmally in presenting European citizens with the kind of choices that politics should involve. If there is no choice, and if you are simply asked to choose between two lists that usually include what the French call illustres inconnus, rather unknown candidates, with no different platforms and no different policies about European affairs, why are you then surprised that citizens do not bother to turn up and vote? Or if they do vote, they express some kind of protest against the government in power, against the establishment, against life, the world, whatever. Right? Now, we have failed. We have failed. I think most national political leaders have failed to talk in European terms about European issues. I don't want them to talk in European terms about education policies, because this remains a national prerogative, right? But there are things that are decided and managed at the European level. Those things that are decided and managed at the European level generally involve choices. Those choices are almost never presented to citizens. So it is all a technocratic blur that does not concern the average citizen. So as long as that continues, people will vote increasingly with their feet, and this will become more dangerous. So what is my solution? Well, not easy. It's interesting. We are trying to create democracy in a supranational setting. Nobody has done that before. Right? So it's going to be difficult, admittedly. It will take time. I hope it takes less time, because if it does take a lot of time, the whole European construction will be in danger. Because we can no longer rely on the kind of permissive consensus that we had in the early decades of European integration. So from now on, it's going to be more rough. And more rough because time has passed, because of deepening of integration, and because there are also many new countries that have not yet discovered or may find difficult in discovering the joys, quote-unquote, of European integration. So unless the system becomes much more political, the whole project becomes much more political, I think it is in real danger. And for me, it's a danger because some of the basic achievements of European integration are very important, at least for somebody like me. And losing some of them will imply a very serious cost. Now, I'm not sure I understood what you meant. It is true that European law supersedes national law. This is a fact, and it is now mentioned explicitly in the new constitutional treaty. But it's been a practice for many, many years. So everybody who deals with European integration knows that a legislation emanating from European institutions, when it comes in opposition with national legislation, supersedes it. Is it good or bad? Well, for the issues that relate to powers of the European Union, I think it is inevitable. Is it dangerous for the nation state? And does it affect national sovereignty? It does. But if you participate in the European Union, you have to accept that sovereignty is a relative concept. It is not an absolute concept. And if those who have an idea of sovereignty as an absolute concept either live in a different world or certainly reject the European Union, or both. But that's all I would say about it. I'm sure that this is a matter that appears as threatening to some people. I respect it. If they are too many people, or if they are the majority, then it becomes a political issue. Now, how does one define relations with the United States? What is worrying is that, at least this is the message one gets sometimes from many of the neocon members of the Bush administration, is that European unity of any sort is not a desirable thing any longer. And it is actually seen as threatening by several members of the new political establishment in the United States. This is new. If this continues, and it's going to be interesting, it's going to be crucial, in fact, to see what happens in the next few years. It's going to be crucial to discover whether President Bush, in his second term, will be looking not only for followers, but also for allies. And there's an important distinction between the two. If he only looks for followers, then Europeans will be faced with very awkward and difficult choices. And I'm not sure what is going to be the outcome of those choices. And this affects not only the attempt to establish a common foreign security policy, but it affects European integration in general. And I don't know what's going to be the outcome.
Thanks. Perhaps time for a couple of last questions. Katerina.
Do you think enlargement was a mistake?
Can we match it as well? Is there a question here?
My name is Giuseppe Mazzone. I'm a consultant. Do you think there is a plan B for the UK? What I mean is, the country where there is most likely a chance of a problem in ratifying the constitution is the UK. In case the others go on and the UK doesn't, can the UK behave like Norway or Switzerland? I mean, is it in the interest in the UK, and will the UK accept it, and will the rest of Europe accept it?
Thanks. Any other last question? The chap over here, and then we'll come.
Milara Philip, a student, second year, geography economics. You mentioned the importance of dealing with losers. Do you identify any particular groups or any particular areas that fit into this category, and you propose any solutions?
Okay, I'm going to take two final questions. I have people waving to me profusely, but the lady at the back here.
Thank you. Vasiliki Hadzipetrou from King's College London. The kind of superstate democracy you're talking about, allow me to say cosmopolitan democracy, obviously goes through the redefinition of sovereignty. Do you think Europeans are mature enough to adapt their diversity as the cornerstone of their European sovereignty? Thank you.
Thanks. and then we're going to take the question. Oh, but there is a microphone upstairs. Thank you.
Hi, it's Barış Karapınar from Destin. On the question of Turkey, you said it is too poor, too big, and too different. Then why accept it at all? Because you said you're in favor of accepting Turkey in the long run. And is it because it is vital for European security and geostrategy? My second question is, do you realistically think that the European Union will ever be a serious international player if it continues to rely on soft power and if it continues to rely on the wishful thinking that the United States will remain as ally? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Whilst Turkey has been mentioned, why not ask Lukács to comment on whether Turkey should be required to recognize the government of Cyprus as well? Why not throw in an additional controversy? Go on.
Why allow Turkey? Because I can give you two different kinds of answers to that. As a Greek, I have a much stronger interest in a European Turkey than as a European, if I may make the distinction between the two. As a Greek, I have an interest in having a stable, democratic, prosperous neighbor who behaves according to rules. All right? As a European, I'm much more concerned about the effects the accession of a big, poor, and different country may have on the functioning of the European political system. Now, how does one reconcile the two? Well, sometimes people don't. My position still on Turkey is that there's a long history of relations with Turkey. Nobody doubted in the past the European so-called vocation of Turkey. It is a bit too late to discover, or some people in Europe, to discover that Turkey is not European enough, so it does not belong to the European Union. So I'm all in favor of starting accession negotiations. I know that the accession negotiations are going to last for at least 10 years. And I will be in favor of the accession of Turkey on a number of conditions. So first of all, that Turkey in the process has become a country which is easier to integrate in the Union. Second, that this is going to be a decision that is not going to be taken against the wish of the large majority of European citizens. And I'm not a demagogue here. I think that European citizens need to be convinced, and this will take time. And third, that there is a union that functions to be able to take Turkey in. These are important conditions, and we will discover whether they are fulfilled in the next 10 years or so. Now, should Turkey recognize the Republic of Cyprus, I think that Turkey will very soon sign the Customs Union Agreement, which will indirectly recognize the Republic of Cyprus. Of course.
It has already.
No? No. Not with all countries. Not with the new members. So by signing a customs union agreement with all 25, it will indirectly recognize. I know that as a Greek, I would very much like Turkey to recognize the Republic of Cyprus. I also understand that it is not the easiest of things to ask of Mr. Erdogan. And I think that this is something to be solved soon once the accession negotiations start. I'm trying to be as conciliatory as possible.
Yes, I can tell.
The Greek Ministry of Foreign Affairs may not like me for what I've just said, but I'm an independent person. Now, redefinition of sovereignty and are the Europeans mature enough? But we have redefined sovereignty already in practice. If people have not discovered that we have redefined it, well, tough luck, but they better do. But this is how we've been running the show for the last 30 or 40 years. And it is, I mean, the problem is really that, and this is a point I made in the beginning, that if you think about it, the difference between the importance of the functions performed by the Union and the knowledge of those functions by the average European citizen is huge. And that presents a major political and problem and for the functioning of European democracies. I understand that it is not easy, but it is something that needs to be tackled soon, because we can be in deep trouble. How does one tackle the problem of losers? Well, of course, it is mostly losers or potential losers that are rallying against European integration, and they are shifting towards the right and the left of the political spectrum. Europe is faced with rapid change. Rapid change involves losers. It has always involved losers. It was easier to deal with them in the 50s and the 60s because it was a context of high growth. So one can absorb the problem of losers in a more dynamic, growing economy. It has become extremely difficult to deal with them in the context of a relatively stagnant economy. The problem of losers is essentially a problem for national welfare states, and they have to deal with them. We do not want, I think, at least those people like me who attach importance to equality and solidarity, we do not want to see the things that have happened, let's say, in the United States in terms of rapidly growing inequalities. So the structural reforms, which are unpopular, have to go hand in hand with measures that are at least providing effective safety nets for a large number of potential losers in the process. You can do that more easily if you create the conditions for higher growth. It will become virtually impossible to do so in conditions of zero growth or 1% growth that has characterized most of European countries. And was there any other question?
Was enlargement a mistake?
Sorry. Was enlargement a mistake? No, it wasn't a mistake. It took pretty long time to materialize. I mean, after all, enlargement of the former communist countries became an issue from the moment that the communist regimes collapsed. So if you think about it, it's been like 15 years until they actually joined. The number of things have not, however, happened. So I think that enlargement had to happen. If the European Union refuses the admission of democratic countries that want to join in the project and does so for a long time, it will deny itself and it will reject its own raison d'etre. What could have happened is that we could have had the constitution, instead of having Nice already functioning, so it would have been easier to accept and incorporate the new countries in the European system. We failed because both Amsterdam and Nice took place in anticipation of enlargement, and both of them were failures. Basically, they did not deliver the goods. So then we tried for a third time. This time we have produced something better, but God knows when it's going to be put into effect and how. So my answer is it was not a mistake, but some other things should have happened. And also, for those people who thought that enlargement would be a smoother operation, they, I think, tended to underestimate the political and economic problems of the new members. They have tended to underestimate, for example, the consequence or the what kind of political scars those societies have after 50 years of totalitarian rule. And we are going to see the effects every day as members of the European Council and in the way their democratic systems operate. Now, the UK, the most difficult question. I obviously very much hope that there is a majority in favor of the constitution in the UK. Mr. Blair has wisely decided to have the referendum after virtually all other referenda have taken place. So assuming that the other referenda produce a yes vote, there will be a very difficult decision with which UK voters will be faced, because it will not be so much a question as to whether you like the constitution or not, because I think one knows that if virtually every other country ratifies and only one or two do not, it is highly unlikely that the constitution will be put on the shelf and forgotten. There is too much political capital invested in it. So there's going to be a very difficult decision for UK citizens. And I think that the only way the British government or anybody can win the referendum is by talking about the bottom line. And the bottom line is, does the UK want, the majority of the population of this country, want to be part of the European project or not? Because the argument that you vote against the constitution because you like or you don't like bits and pieces of it assumes that you prefer Nice. Is that the argument? If that is the argument, I don't find it convincing. So the argument essentially is whether you want a European project in which you participate and countries, the individuals, social and income groups can have different views, and it's all legitimate. But at least let us agree, do we want a European framework or not? And that is really the bottom line.
Well, thank you. I think we should bring the proceedings to a halt. I'm tempted to thank Luca for his rather narrow talk, I thought, this evening. It's a pity that we didn't raise some broader questions. But I think this would be grossly unfair. So on your behalf, more accurately, I would like to thank Lucas for his wide-ranging talk, the breadth of his answers and contributions, and also for your questions as well. So on your behalf, many thanks to our speaker this evening, Lucas Doukalis. And to remind you, there is a reception on the fifth floor in the staff common room beginning now.